Now, that was back in the 80s when wolves were basically badass predators who were out to get you and would probably steal your babies. And, of course, now wolves are like penguins because we love them, don't we? They're like baby seals. They're the new sort of poster child of the environmental movement. And Ted Lefroy is here to tell the story of how wolves tell the story of how we think. Hello, Ted Lefroy.
Morning, Rick.
Ted, if you haven't come across Ted, he's the director for the Centre for Environment at the University of Tasmania, and every now and then he just comes in and drops a diamond of thought into our minds about, well, I suppose the nature of science, how we relate to it, how it changes how we relate to the world. So what do the wolves have to tell us, Ted?
Well, they tell us how our understanding of the natural environment is an ever-evolving story. And a lot of science, especially environmental science, is provisional. There always seems to be a new chapter. The story of the wolves in Yellowstone National Park has become fairly well known as a story of salvation and redemption. So when it was declared a national park in 1872, one of the first things they did is get rid of the things that they didn't want people to see, which is wolves and cougars and the Native American Indians who lived there. So they were pushed out of the park.
That was how policy went in those days, wasn't it? They said, let's have a national park. Okay, yeah. Item one, things to shoot.
Well, it's really set in train. You think the director, what's he going to look to? He looks to the act, and the act that set it up said that Yellowstone was to be a pleasuring ground for the benefit and welfare of the people. So I thought, right, what do people want? They want elk and bison. They want big herds of grazing animals. They don't want to be troubled by wolves or grizzly bears or cougars. So, I mean, those were the values of the time, and that was the policy. So by 1926, there were no wolves in Yellowstone. They'd effectively got rid of them. It was safe for people.
It's a bit like people saying how good it is we got the rats off Macquarie Island. And in 50 years, who knows what disastrous consequences that could have.
Yeah, although the rats never really, they were brought there by ships.
Know.
But the thing is with the wolves is that what the Park Service then had on their hands is how do we manage this burgeoning population of elk? So instead of being about 3,000 or 4,000, they got up to 10,000 and 15,000. And so they have a big campaign shooting the elk. And then visitors were seeing starving elk along the roadside because they'd eaten everybody out of house and home. And then the strange things that happened was the elk started eating the willows and the elders along the riverbanks, and that's what the beavers need to eat and to build their dams. So they up sticks and left, and that changed the hydrology. So the dams broke down and the rivers became these incised streams, and there's no more flooded floodplains with willows. So it actually changed the hydrology and it changed the landscape physically. And by the 1960s, there was such an outcry about meddling with nature, the Park Service then said, right, hands off. We have a new policy. It's called natural regulation. And this is a classic case of, you've heard of evidence-based policy, which is the mantra in government these days, that every good policy must be backed up by sound evidence.
Well, yes.
In the case of Yellowstone, it was policy-based evidence. They went out looking for research that supported their policy of natural regulation. And they ignored studies about the importance of wolves and predators controlling grazing animals and said, no, we believe it's bottom-up regulation. It's the amount of grass that controls the number of elk. It's got nothing to do with wolves. And they actually searched for papers that supported this, and one of them was a study of deer in New Zealand.
There you go.
And another was buffalo in Africa.
So what do they think? You plant more grass, you get more elk?
No, they reckon it's rainfall, soil conditions, weather, uh-huh. Grass, elk.
Okay.
So there were two competing theories in ecology at the time, bottom up, top down.
Yep.
Bottom up, it's the amount of grass, it's the sunshine, the rain. That controls the population of grazers. The top down people said, no, it's the keystone predator. And that battled out. And then finally, 1995, they relented. They introduced 30 wolves from Canada. There are now 80 wolves in 10 packs. The elk population has come down to something like around 3,000 or 4,000. But... and if you go on YouTube, there's a lovely little 3-minute video narrated by George Monbiot from The Guardian, and it tells this lovely story about how they've restored this Eden, that the wolves have brought the elk population back down, the willows have come back, the beavers have come back, they're eating the willow, building the dams, the rivers are now a chain of ponds, everything's happy in paradise.
And that's why you need people like Alan Bond. in an economic scale, you need those top-level predators or the economy doesn't work. Is that right? Is that how it works? That's yes. It's the triumph tribute for the 1%, isn't it? Without us and our trickle-down economy, you'd be stuffed.
Well, there's a
the money, the rivers of money wouldn't flow.
The tide that raises all boats. The trouble recent paper in Nature sort of punches a hole in that lovely story of paradise reconstructed.
So let's just, before we get into this paper, because this is the point where most people's knowledge sits, right? We've heard the wolves got reintroduced and everything was made better.
Yeah.
And you need these top level predators. It's 20 to 7 on 936 ABC Hobart. You're listening to Ted Lefroy, Director of the Centre for Environment at the University of Tasmania, with this fabulous three-act story about our understanding about the role of top-level predators and their relationship to the environment. And it's about how our knowledge grows over time and changes over time and why our understanding of the environment's always provisional, which leads to a question I'm going to ask you at the end of this as to how you ever set any kind of policy settings, because you're obviously wrong all the time. But first, Act 3.
Yeah. Okay.
What happened?
Act 3 is people said, well, let's go and actually measure the regrowth. Come on.
Yeah. The measurement.
Of the willows along the river banks. And what they found is 100 years of this overgrazing by elk and the change it made to through the erosion and the change in the rivers means the willows actually aren't coming back. And the beaver is still a fairly rare animal in Yellowstone. They're constructing artificial dams. Because it's a bit chicken or the egg.
Not the beavers, presumably.
No. The humans. Yeah. The humans. So until you have flooded areas around the side of the river, you don't get willow. And without willow, you don't get the beaver. And without the beaver, you don't get the dam.
Yeah.
So what they're really saying is it'll never go back to how it was. The landscape, the ecology has been changed dramatically. Not just by that 100 years of sort of uncontrolled grazing, but also their other policy was initially if whenever a fire broke out, they'd put it out. Anything bigger than a square foot was a danger, and they put it out. When they went to this natural regulation policy in the 60s, they let anything burn everywhere, and in 1988 a third of the park burned. So it's had dramatic changes. And the lesson is you can never go back in time in ecology. It will be different. It will have a fuller complement of species and the wolves are back, but you actually can't recreate the Eden that was 1872. And what we've got now is still natural, it's still beautiful, it's still to be managed. But the idea that George Monbiot's little fairy story, I think, is deceptive because it makes us think, you know, we have sinned and now we can redeem ourselves and reconstruct what was there.
The question is, of course, who these parks are for, isn't it? Are they for the pleasure of the people? And should we therefore be, as we are at the moment, putting luxury resorts in them and finding ways to make them more accessible and to make it easy for me to get my nana in and all of that kind of thing? Or are they for nature to be completely natural and therefore only accessible if you can, you know, rock climb over a mountain gorge with one arm tied behind your back, which you chewed off because you were trapped under a boulder having walked in on your hands? Who are national parks for?
They're for both, aren't they? They're for nature and they're for people. And the way that a lot of parks authorities manage this is through zoning. And the debate in Tasmania about that word wilderness, I mean, the important thing is that people do get there. You don't exclude people entirely. But in the 60s, we went through this period of sort of misanthropy, you know, of hatred of all things human. We are wrong. We have meddled. Stand back and it'll all be right.
Well, there's still people operating whose ideas were formed then.
Yeah, exactly.
And you can hear that behind the way that they would like to see policy formed.
Yeah.
But Ted, if all of our understanding of environment's provisional, and more importantly, our understanding of how we impact on our environment is provisional, how do we set policy?
Okay, the way we do it is you've got to set it on the best available information at the time, but if you know it's provisional, then every intervention you make in order to manage the environment needs to be designed as an experiment to test that idea, because you know it's provisional. It's called adaptive management. It's been around since the 1980s. And what it means is if we go in to do any particular management, whether it's controlled burning, or whether it's eradicating weeds or reintroducing native species that have become locally extinct, if every intervention is designed so that you can determine what effect you've had, you're not assuming you're right. You're saying, look, it's an open question. And that is In other words, that assuming that something is absolutely settled and we don't need to monitor it, we just go out and do it, has been the danger for the perhaps the last half of the 20th century.
But in terms of getting stuff done, sometimes government needs to not consult for 20 million years and go, we're not doing anything till you've gathered the evidence. They need to take action. They need to make things happen.
Yeah, well, what I'm saying is don't wait until people have done lots of experiments, then act. Make the intervention the experiment.
Okay, so you can go for it.
Yeah.
But just measure it.
As long as you measure it so you know what effect you've had. For instance, there's the Alpine National Park in Victoria is at the moment suffering from an explosion of deer. Introduced species. There's six species of deer introduced in Australia, and a couple of them are really starting to have an impact on the Alps. So the park rangers designed an experiment where they could use recreational shooters in some areas and not others.
I thought you were going to say they put wolves in.
No.
That'd be awesome.
No. Well, the nearest thing we've got is shooting. And what they wanted to do was to see could. Some effort through recreational shooters where we close parts of the park, could that have an impact? And they asked us to come and help to design, people from the University of Tasmania to help design the experiment. It was all designed so that they would actually know. There were lots of camera traps up. There was a rough sense of the population beforehand. You know how much impact was put in. But then, you know, finances got in the way and the budget wasn't big enough to run it as a replicated experiment. So they just went in and did it in one little area. And the sad thing is they'll never actually know if that had an impact and that's effective.
They could have paid for it by getting the hunters to pay money to do that as a sport. I mean, it's fun. People will pay money for that. Do you know, I read a story a couple of years ago now. Do you know how much government policy is measured?
You tell me.
1%. Nearly every policy that's announced gets put in place. No one ever looks at it again. No one ever measures it. No one ever talks about it. They just happen. No one ever looks back.
No, and that's the thing. Medicine and public health is probably the area that set the standard. And there are very good records and public programs are monitored and measured. And they have kind of set the standard of how this should happen. And it's the same with environmental management.
So there's a case in a way to say that actually not just environmental policy should have some scientific processes attached to it, but actually all of our government policies should be understood as an experiment and treated in the same way about, well, how's it being measured and where's the rigor around that and how are you reporting that and which respected journal are the results going to be published in, not just some rag that'll publish any old thing?
Exactly. And part of it is, I think, accommodating uncertainty. It's not something we're used to. You remember Joe Bjelke-Petersen's line was, don't you worry about that. That's my job. We'll worry about that. But nowadays, everybody has a stake in these things and rightly is asking questions. And the questions they should be asking is, if you're going to mount a multi-million dollar public campaign to improve education standards, health standards, the state of the environment, the question should be, is it so designed you'll know if it's had an effect? And that's really the question we should be asking. Can you tell if where you've been? Can you measure your impact? And that, and you know, that's how we learn. The idea that...
Yeah, see, that's like in maths, they used to say, how did you get to that answer, Rick? And I say, I don't know, it's just the answer. And they go, if you can't show you're working, I can't mark you on that. I said, is it right or not? They said, well, if you can't show your work, is it right or not? They go, it's right. How did you get there? I go, I don't know. They said, you get it right all the time. I'm like, I know. How do you get, I don't know.
Well, you see,
I was a hopeless mathematician, couldn't show my working. They weren't interested. I wasn't interested. We parted ways.
But intuitively brilliant.
Well, lucky. Whatever. I should have been a gambler. I don't know. I haven't got the guts for that. So there you go. Public policy. Ted, great to talk to you this morning.
You too, Rick. Thanks a lot.
And wolves shortly to be reintroduced into the Tasmanian wilderness as our apex predator. 10 to 7 on 936 ABC Hobart.